Good morning, everyone. Thank you for attending today's session of the Personal Theology Program at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Berkeley. We're very happy to see you for our first program here in the new year. And just to let you know, we've got a lot of exciting programs coming up through the rest of the church year through May. And please watch the Beacon on the Hill, the calendar on the website, and for the UUCB discuss list announcements. And I'm sure you'll find quite a variety that you'll enjoy. I wanted to read our land acknowledgement. Excuse me. As we begin, we take this moment to acknowledge that this church occupies land in what was known as Huchin, the unceded territory of the Chochenyo-speaking Ohlone people. As community and church members, we continue to benefit from the seizure and occupation of this land. We also want to affirm that this is not simply performative, but is deeply felt and is a commitment toward action. Our speaker today is one of our favorites, Rabbi Harry Manhoff, who has graced our program many years with wonderful presentations that are very informative. And Rabbi Harry is a graduate of Yale and is a transplant from the East Coast to the West Coast, and that's very fortunate for us. He is Rabbi Emeritus of Temple Beth Shalom in San Leandro, and he teaches part-time at St. Mary's College. His topic today is Care First, Jail Last. And with that, I will turn it over to Rabbi Harry. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for the land, beautiful land acknowledgement. It's something that we really have to pay attention to and act upon. We can all pay the shumi, which is, I can't pronounce it, but the land tax that we owe the natives, Native Americans from this area. And it's a way that we can pay back a little tiny bit of what we owe. So I, as you can see, I'm sitting in the first century Jerusalem, where I'm most comfortable. I'm a first century kind of guy. As you know, I study my doctorates in New Testament studies and the origins of Christianity, which takes us exactly to the Second Temple time. And there you see the Second Temple behind me over my shoulder. I don't know whether it's my right shoulder or my left shoulder. I do know it from my left, but I don't know my zoom right from my zoom left. So that's just going to be my background for a few minutes before I get into the two different PowerPoint presentations that I have that I want to go over with you. But first, you can't see my tie. I wish you could. My tie is a forest with trees, and that's because the last time I was with you, I believe, was 2 years ago or maybe more, but it was to sell, during the holiday of Tu B'Shvat, which is the 15th of the month of Shvat. And it's one of our four New Years on the calendar. It's the New Year of Trees. And I spoke to you about my experience of planting trees in Israel and planting while I was actually in Israel and planting trees in my own property. We planted parsley with our granddaughter so that we'll have parsley for Passover in a little over 2 months. And so, it is indeed the time of Tu B'Shvat. So I wish you a happy new year or happy new year of trees. And that'll get us to my topic for today. Temple Bethel, Congregation Bethel Tolt Committee, Tikkun Olam Leadership Team, which is Tikkun Olam means repair of the world. It's one of the committees that I serve on at Temple Bethel as a member, I like to say, a Jew in the pew. Where I don't have that many responsibilities. Our job is to prepare the world, and nothing too big, but we're gonna do it. So we're very, very much involved in the creation and the final building of the tiny house village that is now in Oakland, right near the Oakland Coliseum, where we built 22 houses for homeless youth. We have two on-site managers and other professionals who come and provide extra services to our young people with the hope that within 2 years they can get back on their feet and either finish their education or get out there and work and make a life again. So that project was phenomenal. I think you actually had some of the tiny houses parked at the church the last time I was here.
Yeah.
So and now they're occupied, and it's a wonderful project. And we were involved in that for a long time. When that got settled, we moved on to what was known as DAC, Decarcerate Alameda County. And I'll explain how DAC has evolved now into Care Not Cages, or Care Not Jail. And unfortunately, people get spooked by words like decarcerate, and they don't understand the problems that we're facing, which I hope to present to you. So I'm going to go into my my screen share, and I'm going to share with you some basic information about our jail. And let's see. So we figured out how to do this. Here we go. Okay. Okay. So this is our campaign, the Care First campaign. And what we're trying to do mainly is to get the sheriff out of the business of mental health care and to do what he does, which is to incarcerate prisoners, people who have broken the law. What happens is that people with mental health crisis get picked up by the police and they get taken to our jail where they are cared for, supposedly. So our county sends money. I'm sure that Contra Costa County does the same thing, but Alameda County pays for the jail to hold people in the jails when they should be receiving mental health care. So here's the problem. We went to the Board of Supervisors and we said to them, we need money for mental health care in Alameda County. And they said, okay, well, we'll expand the jail and put more mental health workers in the jail. These are your mental health workers that you're looking at. Very nice people, have nothing wrong with them except they're police officers and not mental health specialists. 44% of the people in Alameda County Jail, which is Santa Rita Jail, are there because of mental health crisis. Okay, that means that they've been picked up for acting irrationally or whatever and taken to the jail. They do not, most of them have not been booked for a crime. Therefore, they're not waiting for a trial. They're just sitting there, supposedly getting mental health care. Alameda County has the highest percentage of people with mental illness in the prison system. Besides the fact that we're dealing with a crisis of mental health, we're also dealing with a racial crisis. You can see by population that in Alameda County, about 10% of our population is African-American, but in the county jail, almost 50% are African-American. When I worked way back in the past, when I worked for the federal government down in Lompoc at the federal penitentiary, 50% of the prison population was African-American. And as you know, only 15% of the country is African American. So we're dealing with a racial problem besides a mental health problem. We are the second Alameda County. I don't see Contra Costa. Does anybody see it on the list here? There it is. Can you see my cursor? You guys are not that far behind us. We're the second, though, of having the most people in jail who have not been sentenced, who are awaiting either a trial or awaiting a booking for a crime. And that's this huge, huge percentage of people. This is just these are all facts that we could spend time on. I just want to point out that in Alameda County, the Justice Department took a case against Alameda County for this specifically for this problem, violation of the 8th and 14th Amendments, filed on behalf of people, present and future women at the Santa Rita Jail. And so the settlement that was worked out with the county was the Babu settlement, and that was in 2018. Last week, we were opposing the Babu settlement because a significant part of the funds that Alameda County has decided to deal with this problem is going to expanding the jail and expanding the jail staff. So, and there are other cases that have been brought against Alameda County. I don't know exactly what's going on in Contra Costa County, but I can't imagine it's very different. So we got the, we said we did it. We went to the Board of Supervisors and we got them to pass a resolution to change the emphasis, put the funding into mental health and away from the jail with this promise to do it. The problem is the promise has not been carried out yet. I'm sure you're aware of the fact that Wilma Chan, of blessed memory, passed away this year. She was one of our biggest advocates. And so we pretty much have to go to the other supervisors. I don't know who your supervisor is, but we're in direct contact with our supervisors and trying to make this. So this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to advocate with members of the County Board of Supervisors through email. And we do individual meetings. Back, I remember when we had the tiny house village, it was almost a full-time job for me to go and meet with supervisors and city council members, things like that. All of whom, gave us a lot of support, verbal support. And when it came down to spending the dollars, they somehow disappeared. So we go to the Board of Supervisors meetings online and try to speak. At this last week, there were, I think, 150 people who were qualified to speak against the Babu settlement. And so the county started to reevaluate it, which is wonderful. So this is where we're, so I'm gonna stop sharing this. And I wanna go into the main reason I'm here today, which is to the Jewish point of view for this. And so I'm gonna go to a couple more things here. Now I figured out how to do this from the beginning. Okay. This is the Jewish values that we're dealing with. Teshuvah is one of the most basic concepts in the Jewish tradition. Teshuvah literally means return. And it's returning to our values. We have three steps. You have to apologize. You have to make restitution. And then you go to God and God will forgive us. And this is one of our basic things. How long have we been working on this problem? Only at least since the time of Isaiah. Let's put it, somewhere around 600 before the Common Era. So, a good 2.5 millennia. As you can see that the prophet Isaiah said, this is what God requires us to do, that God has created us and appointed us as a covenant people, a light of nations, to open the eyes deprived of light, rescue prisoners from confinement, from the dungeon, those who sit in darkness. This is the first thing that God said for Isaiah to tell us, makes us a covenant people and light of nations, to open the eyes of the blind and rescue prisoners. And so it's something we've been working on for a long time. So I want to go now to not specifically to prisoners, but to those with mental incapacity. In the Talmud, Chagiga is a section of the Talmud that deals with minor holidays. And the sages taught, who's considered mentally incompetent? One who goes out alone at night or sleeps in the cemetery or rends his garments. It was stated that Rav Huna said, one does not have the halachic status, the legal status of a mentally incompetent person until there are all of these signs present in that person at the same time. And Rabbi Yochanan said, I think that one is considered mentally challenged, even due to the appearance of one of these signs. So what is the point here? Is that the rabbis are looking for behavior that is unusual, so that that unfortunately today, if it happens, somebody calls the police. Okay. And the rabbis are trying to deal with this. So there's a story about one of the rabbis who talks to his father and says, what happens if somebody is forced to eat matzah on Passover? Has he fulfilled the Jewish law? Okay, if you're forced to do something, it doesn't count. So if you're forced to commit a crime, that doesn't count. But what if you're forced to do something you're supposed to do? Does it count? And so the rabbis say, who would force somebody to eat matzah on Passover? I mean, my children insist that I force them to eat matzah on Passover, but I don't think that's what we're talking about. So they say, if we say that a demon forced him, okay, that a demon forced him to eat in a moment of mental discomfort, distress, it is taught in another place with regard to someone who is at times mentally well and at times mentally unwell, the times when he is mentally well, those are considered competent legal actions and are obligatory. But when somebody is in mental distress, he or she is considered mentally in distress all the time, even if it's only part-time, and therefore exempt from the commandments of God, the mitzvot. And so someone who's compelled by a demon to eat matzah is not considered obligated to perform the mitzvot. So it doesn't matter whether you get credit or don't get credit, because what he's doing is not legally required at that particular moment. So Rav Ashi, another rabbi, comes along and says, no, we're not talking about demons. We're talking about the Persians. We know the Persians. We can't trust the Persians. A Persian caused them to eat matzah. And then they say, what? What are you talking about? Because there's another place in the Talmud which says that we learn from the Persians' manners. I mean, the Persians are the ideal people in the world to learn manners from. So the conversation goes on. So what if somebody blows a shofar on Rosh Hashanah? But not for the purpose of Rosh Hashanah, just to blow the shofar. Has that person fulfilled the obligation of the shofar? That's a question. So Rashi, our medieval commentator from about the end of the 12th century, the end of the 11th century, I'm sorry, end of the 11th century, says that somebody who blows a shofar in order to make music, okay, and make a song, that is not for the purpose of blowing the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, just to play a song. I heard from my teacher, one who blows the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, lashed, not lashir, not to sing, but lashed, that is to chase away a ruach ra'ah, a evil spirit, fulfills his obligation. Since he heard the shofar, even though he didn't, wasn't blowing it for the right reason. Okay, okay, never mind. So then what happens is that Rashi's explanation gets a little more expanded. I'm going to skip that one for now. Let's go on to another Mishnah. This is now, the Mishnah was edited somewhere around the year 200. The rest of the Gemara, the rest of the Talmud, maybe between 600 and 1,000, who knows? But the Mishnah says in Erovim, and Erovim is the tractate that deals with Shabbat boundaries. How far can you go on Shabbat? You're not allowed to walk more than 2,000 amah, or amot, which amounts to about, I don't know, 3,000 feet or 1,000 yards, a football field. That's as far as you're allowed to walk on Shabbat. So what happens to somebody who is forcibly taken out beyond the Shabbat limit? What if it was an evil spirit that caused him? That is, he was mentally unwell, and found himself in a moment of clarity outside of Shabbat limit. What can he do? And the answer is, he's responsible as any other person that your 1,000 amot is no longer applicable because you've passed that boundary. Now you only have your own 4 cubits. What's 4 cubits or 4 amot? That's the size of a grave. So you're allowed to walk 6 feet in any direction, but once you pass that, you've violated Shabbat, which is very serious. So the Gemara, which is the discussion of the Mishnah, says, since the Gemara discussed one step beyond the Shabbat limit due to an evil spirit, the Gemara cites another Mishnah, another Braita, in which the sages taught, 3 matters cause people to act against their own will and the will of their maker. And they are, and the last two are, an evil spirit and the depths of extreme poverty. So for the rabbis, an evil spirit or mental illness and extreme poverty are things that the Gemara says at the very bottom that we have to request mercy for people who suffer from these terrible situations, mental disability, mental illness, and poverty. Notice what's not in that list. You're not supposed to take them to jail. So what do you do about mental illness? Well, the Talmud in the Yoma, which is the tractate on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, says, I'm going to move you because you people are in my way. Okay. The Gemara explains that in another verse in Proverbs, it says, if there's a care in a person's heart, let that person quash it. Okay, the word is yashchena. But Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Ashi disputed, what does the word yashchena mean? What does it mean to quash it? And so one of them said that he should yashchena, and that is to push it out of one's mind. So to use whatever means are available, medical treatments, counseling, whatever, to try to alleviate the pain of mental illness. You should try to use these means to banish concerns from his heart. And the other rabbi said, no, it means yashihena, which means that that person should tell others his concern. That is, talking therapy is something that they began talking about 1,000 years ago or more. This is a long passage that I'm just going to summarize for you, but it was over 1,000 years ago that they started discussing this. And it was in Tel Aviv, the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, who wrote an opinion about just jails in general for modern society. And he said, punishment is not a goal in itself. And it's the purpose of incarceration is to help somebody to do right, so that they'll listen and be in awe of God. What benefit is prison from this? Prisons have existed for many different forms forever. And it's been proven that it very rarely, if at all, ever rehabilitates criminals. That it usually causes more harm than good. And people who are released from prison end up in a much more serious situation than before. He says the basics of Jewish perspectives on life is human freedom and the social nature of human beings, and that we are all created in the image of God, and that no other person has the right to confine the human spirit of movement, of freedom, which is the holiest of holies among all of the God's creations in every generation. And so most recently it was the board of, rabbis of the Central Conference of American Rabbis, the reform movement that I am a part of, that passed its resolution saying that according to the National Coalition of the Homeless, approximately 20-25% of single adult homeless population in the United States suffer from some severe and persistent mental illness. Many of these are homeless, mentally ill individuals end up in the criminal system, et cetera. So the Central Conference of American Rabbis calls for the increased attention to the many inmates in our nation's prisons with mental illness, focusing on the need to encourage the diversion of nonviolent, mentally ill criminal offenders into the community-based mental health programs, and also work to ensure that individuals with mental illness sentenced to prison receive appropriate and humane treatment, including access to appropriate medication. We call upon law enforcement agencies to develop policies, practices, and specialized training for police officers and correction officers to recognize and deal appropriately with persons in mental distress. That's the background. What's the solution? We're not saying that there shouldn't be jails. Some people have to be locked away from society. We're also not saying that the worst of the worst should be executed. That's a whole nother discussion of capital punishment, which the Talmud by and large opposes and has been the position of the Jewish community. Hypothetically, since we've never had until this modern state of Israel, the ability to put people to death. The state of Israel has only executed one person in its 70 years, and that was Adolf Eichmann, who designed the final solution for Adolf Hitler. So he's the only person that has ever been put to death in the state of Israel. So capital punishment is a whole nother discussion that we can begin at another time. But so we're not saying that there shouldn't be jails. Sometimes it is required. What we are saying is that the resources that we're wasting making the Santa Rita jail larger so that it can have a mental health clinic is a waste of money. It's not criminal, but it's certainly immoral to take those funds from local organizations that deal with mental illness. There are professionals in the government and outside the government in NGOs that are facing with these problems. Oakland actually has begun a process where you can call, I think it's 611 instead of 911, and get mental health support for somebody who's in crisis rather than calling the police. There are many projects around the Bay Area, around the state of California, and around the West Coast. I don't know beyond the West Coast. I'm sure there are, but I only know what's going on all the way up to Oregon and Washington. There are many programs that have been started to address this. So now that I've bored you to tears with these facts and figures, I'm more than glad to answer any questions that you might have. I don't know how much time we have.
Oh, honey, we've got lots of time, Rabbi Harry. Yes.
Well, I ask me a question. I'll talk.
Oh, okay. So I'm going to, you know, take advantage of my position here on Zoom. And as we know, as you were putting the figures for African-Americans that are incarcerated and the PTSD of racism that makes you crazy, PTSD that's made all of us crazy. And I shouldn't use that word, that has really distorted our point of view. And the human nature of being afraid of anything that's different. I mean, just natural biology. It looks different. And so that's why it seems so resistant to me, the change, because it scares people. So some of the mental health training has to be on our side who don't have the mental health problem. Any response about that?
Well, that's why I was assigned to contact the UU in Berkeley and to enlist your support with the rest of us that are involved in this program. We need continual education on this. We've started a program at the synagogue where we're introducing this in the school to the children, what's going on. and the holiday of Purim, which is coming up next for us, which is a silly, fun, over-the-top holiday where you're supposed to get so drunk you can't tell the good guys from the bad guys. One of the things we do is we put on a show about Esther and Mordecai. For me, this year, I hope I'm creating a play, a spiel for the children in which the sheriff of Nottingham will be King Ahasuerus. And we're going to try to get Maid Marian Esther to be the Prince John's, I made a mistake. So the evil Haman, who Yimach Shemo, is the sheriff of Nottingham, and Esther is Maid Marian, who's become the right-hand advisor to Prince John, it's King Ahasuerus. And we're trying to introduce this problem to them that the people are rounded up, not only because they're Jews and they are different, have different traditions, they look different, you know, they act differently. And therefore, Haman has convinced the prince or the king that they're evil when they're not. And so that's the holiday that we're gonna go over with the children. With the adults, we've had a number of programs about this, beginning on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. The afternoon, I did this presentation very similar to the one that I just showed you, with all the statistics and the Jewish traditions about this. What can we do to educate ourselves? We can educate ourselves. There's plenty of books and there's plenty of articles and things that are out there. Just like I've made, you know, learning more about white privilege, one of the things that I'm reading and learning, teaching myself about. This is another issue that's very high on my agenda. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, it does. And we have people waiting in line. This is wonderful. Bill, can you unmute yourself? Bill Brown is on our board of trustees at UUCB.
Good morning.
Morning, Bill.
Listening to this, I completely support what you are advocating, diverting funds from law enforcement to create a separate entity to deal with mental health. I completely support that. My issue is with one of the first statistics you used, that roughly 50% of the folks in the Alameda County Jail are there for mental health reasons. And that seems incredibly high to me. And I was curious if that is a really good statistic snapshot taken, you know, the week after Christmas when everyone's depressed or whatever it is, or if that's a rolling thing, and how basically right now you can get away with robbery. You can go into a store, fill your cart up and go right out the front, and nobody's going to stop you from the store. The cops aren't going to arrest you if it's under $1,000. Our local Target, people steal somewhere between $20,000 and $40,000 worth of merchandise a day. People break into homes and steal stuff. Oh, it wasn't enough. We're not going to charge you. So there's a whole lot of people getting away with a whole lot of relatively small crime that they would have been arrested 2 years ago, 3 years ago. How has that number changed over time? That's kind of what I'm curious about.
Hey, man, are you attributing all these robberies to African-Americans, Bill Brown?
No.
All right. You know, I got to get you on the defensive early in the day, you know.
No, it just, it's one of those things where, I mean, this is happening nationwide.
Okay. So specifically at San Francisco, which has passed an ordinance that says that they're not going to prosecute crimes under $1,000.
Well, this is beyond San Francisco.
Well, in Alameda, I know that the sheriff's budget increases the more he arrests people. So he's our sheriff. Let me be blunt. I don't like him. I don't like what he's done with our system. And so I have a prejudice against him. So you'll have to use that as a background for my answer to you. But there is inherent to the system, there's a problem in that the more people that are arrested, the larger the jail gets. Okay. And it's overcrowded. And the, just back up two steps, the COVID problem in our jail was amazingly horrible because they warehouse people who are sick in the infirmary, but the infirmary is basically a barracks with double and triple decker beds. And so the COVID if it wasn't, if somebody wasn't put in there for COVID, they certainly had it right away. So that's part of it. Now, the question about the number of people that are in jail for mental illness are the ones who are, have been acting out in public, you know, and people are afraid and they call the police and the police come. Or somebody doesn't like the way that the tent encampment looks and they call the police and the police puts them off until finally they can't anymore and they clean out the encampments. And what do you do with those people? And so they end up in jail. When they clean out an encampment, for example, they don't charge anybody. They just take them, they take away all their property and then they take the people to jail. Sometimes they get charged with loitering or whatever, but most of the time they're not. That's why we have so many people there who are awaiting trial or that haven't been formally charged. In terms of, should there be prisons for people who steal $1,000 or $500 or, you know, a lollipop? I don't know. You know, I think that it's silly to say that somebody can take a shopping cart and roll out of the store with, and nobody should do anything about it. So I'm not going to advocate that. The fact that that Target loses between $20,000 and $40,000 of merchandise a year doesn't surprise me. My son's comic book store, where I don't know what you would steal. He loses a percentage of his inventory to theft. It happens. I'm not saying that it's right or wrong. I'm just saying it happens. Target complaining that it lost $40,000 to the theft when it's a multi-billion dollar, you know, business. You're talking about a lot of insignificant. But then, you know, somebody steals something that they shouldn't, the of value, and they get away with it. Yeah, they do. I'm not going to say they don't. Should they be prosecuted? I think so. Should somebody in Target who, you know, starts yelling at customers and starts, you know, screaming that it's the wrong day of the week for the store to be open or whatever. And so the manager calls the police and police take that person away. It'd certainly be a lot better if we had mental health social workers who could come and help settle the person down and help the person get the care that he or she might need. So you're absolutely right. I don't think that anywhere else in the county besides San Francisco has that law, and I don't know why San Francisco passed that law. I would like to discuss that with them sometime privately.
Thank you, Karen Voorhees. Thanks, Bill. Always.
Hi. Yes, I am delighted to hear that you are involved with these issues and that your community and communities are involved with these issues and that UUs are in there swinging. This is not one of my main focuses in life, but it's an issue that I think about a lot. When I was in a previous spiritual organization, one of my positions of responsibility involved dealing with people who were very disruptive. And it is not everybody's cup of tea to be able to handle somebody who has a serious mental health issue. But it is some of us are constituted so that we can handle it without blowing out ourselves. A lot of us aren't. And so as I wrestle with these issues, and I'm going to work around to a question to you, but my statement is, I envision a justice system where the funds are and training are distributed differently, because the problem in the overview as I see it is that in the United States, we have effectively criminalized mental illness, we've criminalized substance abuse, and we have criminalized poverty, especially if you're a person of color. And these three areas overlap in very complicated ways. And then the police are trained for law enforcement. If you break a law, if you steal something or you mug somebody, that's a criminal act. You've harmed another person, and there are laws and there's a justice system. Our police are trained to do that, and to expect them also to be mental health professionals, to be professionals in substance abuse issues and in people who may have a combination of these things going. I mean, what a strain on the police. So, you know, my background is partly in nonviolent communication. You're familiar with that, yes. And so from nonviolent communication, I've learned the concept of restorative justice rather than retributive justice. And our whole justice system is kind of based on an old guard version of you must punish evildoers, you know, spare the rod, spoil the child, where I hear you and other people working on these issues coming from a deeper place, a more enlightened place, and a more practical place of dealing with what has gone wrong in these people's lives and what do we practically do. I mean, there are some people who need to be incarcerated, like Manson. You know, we need to be, there are some people the rest of us need to be safe from. And we're always going to need jails for some of them. But the United States has four times as many people by percentage of its population in prison as the global average. Are we, you people in the United States, four times more criminal than the rest of the world? I don't think so. And I know these are the issues. This is why I'm so delighted to hear people like you and organizations like yours really working on grappling with the roots of these and shifting all of our institutions. My personal idea is to see the resources that we put into all the police work and the prison systems to be redistributed so that some of that is social work, some of that is mental health work, some of that is substance abuse, and they all work together in teams. And my ideal would be the training of police, that they are trained not to become social workers or mental health workers, but to recognize when they make to a referral, like a primary care physician. When do you refer to a specialist? That would be my dream. And I guess I've already kind of asked you, I guess my question to you was, are you involved with groups that specifically tackle this from an issue of working toward restorative rather than retributive justice, and just a redistribution within the system so that the parts work together? I'd be interested to hear how you're working with other groups like this.
That's a great comment and a great question. Thank you so much. You've taught us all a lot just in your question right now. And nobody has ever accused me of being enlightened or practical.
I'll accuse you of that right now.
So let's pretend that I am. Unfortunately, Alameda County is built on a model that's common throughout the United States, and that is that the jail and the police budgets are dependent on how many people are incarcerated. And now in California, where we have private prisons, the problem has been exacerbated, because now the private prisons are definitely wanting more and more people arrested and put into jail. So, and the system works that way. Just as a background fact, and I'm sure most of you are aware of this, and that is basically our criminal system was created to incarcerate troublesome Negroes. It was a racially based system that was unjust in every way. It really began to return runaway slaves. And so our history of the prison system has not been positive in any sense. And yes, that's exactly what we're trying to do, is get these issues of mental illness and drug abuse turned over to people who are trained to do that, and not to have the police. It's not fair to the police. My daughter, my parents, many people in my family are teachers. It's the same thing. Everything gets dependent. The teachers are supposed to be social workers and drug counselors and deal with and also teach. And the same thing with the police. They're supposed to do a lot of things beyond policing. What can be done about it? Well, as I say, there are programs going on, and we're hoping to expand them. And we would hope that the Alameda County Board of Supervisors would take the money, not use it to expand the jail, but rather to expand these programs that are specifically for that. And yes, we have definitely criminalized mental illness, and we've also criminalized being Black or being non-white. And don't misunderstand me. I'm not accusing policemen of being racists. The system is racist. The policemen that I've had the privilege to work with as a chaplain have been very wonderful people. And I was a chaplain down at San Luis Obispo, as a chaplain in San Leandro, I'm waiting for my health to improve to serve out here too as well. But the system works in such a way that intention is not always what drives what happens. And therefore, I think that everything that you pointed out is correct. And I'm hoping that we can deal with it. It's going to take a lot of voices at a lot of board county board meetings. And at, I worked in, as I said, I worked in the federal system. I worked in the state system. I worked in the county system. I've been in jail as a chaplain. Mac knows all these things all too well. The system is really out of whack and needs a lot of adjustment.
So basically we need a massive systemic overhaul on many fronts. Yeah, I hadn't quite put it together until recently, the degree to which our current criminal police legal system started to return runaway slaves, and also the substance abuse issue. A lot of the drug laws, certainly from the 30s on, were aimed at people of color, Blacks and Latinos specifically. The criminalization of cocaine, heroin, marijuana, and so on. And so this is all, and then the financial incentives are so powerful. I mean, that the whole financial incentive is set up that the more people you put in jail, the more money your system gets. Right. So this has to be changed at a massive systemic level at all, at many levels, from many angles. We got a lot of work to do.
We have a lot of work to do, and we're asking five supervisors in this, and Alameda County, and you know, a minimal number of people to make major, major changes in society. And so Alameda County has appointed a board to deal with this. The county supervisors have from our organization recommended some people that we'd like to see on this board. And at the last minute, they decided that the sheriff should have unequal representation. That is, out of proportion to, or in my opinion, a large percentage of the people on the committee are from law enforcement. And so I don't know how that's going to work. It doesn't, it's not promising. Gloria, can I, is it Gloria or is it, I don't know who's there.
Well, yes, Gloria and I have a concern about how we think about the issue. The mentally ill need help. And we're always worried about, well, we don't want to abridge their freedom. And yet sometimes in order to help them, we have to abridge their freedom a little. We don't want them in jail. We talk about community-based service. So that's great. That's exactly what Ronald Reagan did when he closed all the insane asylums. And when people need help, let's find a way to give them help rather than dithering about, well, we don't want to abridge their freedom at all and things like that. I don't quite know how we approach this, but it seems to be a problem all the time. We have Latterman Short Petrus or whatever law. We can't keep people in psychiatric hold more than 24 hours and things like that. But that doesn't help them and doesn't help society at large.
You're absolutely right, except that I'm pretty sure it was President Kennedy who closed the asylums and not President Reagan.
When he was governor of California, he shut down the California asylums.
Asylums were basically prisons for mentally ill people. There are other inpatient facilities that are available. Something I wanted to answer. I can't remember. It's a point that I'm not opposed to closed facilities. As a rabbi in San Luis Obispo, I had two horrifying experiences. Once where I was able to get somebody who was threatening to commit suicide to be in the 24-hour hold, and that probably saved her life, and one who I didn't get to in time. And I still hold myself responsible, partially responsible for her suicide. So I'm not opposed to helping people who need help at all. And I'm not opposed to having closed facilities. The problem, here's what I want, remember what I want to say. In the county jail, Santa Rita County Jail, some 40% of those people who have been identified with a mental illness end up in administrative detention. That is, the guards aren't trained, and I wouldn't expect them to deal with a mental crisis. The only solution that available now is to put them in administrative detention, what we used to call solitary confinement, which has been recognized worldwide as torture. And people who are experiencing a mental crisis who are put into solitary confinement are a threat to themselves. The Santa Rita County Jail has had, I don't know how many suicides, but way out of proportion to any other county jail that I'm aware of, that we've been studying. So again, putting somebody in solitary confinement is not the solution. Putting somebody into a closed facility for a certain amount of time where they can get treatment from professionals, that's where we need to put the money. That's what we're trying to do. I agree.
Camille, you want to unmute, dear?
Just curious, Rabbi, whether you've seen the movie 13th by Ava DuVernay.
If not,
I think you want to see it. I
have it on my Netflix list. I'm just not a movie person. I will. I'm supposed to see it.
What you're saying so well today just makes me very sad because nothing's happening fast enough, in my opinion. And 13th was my introduction to how horrible things are. But I really, really, really appreciate your being with us today and what you're saying.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Camille. Helen, you want to unmute, Dong?
Thank you so much for your talk today. I think it's something we have all realized, but it's very good to just see it focused. I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that, police people's intentions are not always carried out as they should be. Could you expand on that a little bit, please?
I just would say that as a police chaplain, I've gotten to know a lot of police officers as individuals, as people. And often when they're having their distress and they need somebody to talk to. So that's allowed me to get to know them very personally. And then they get put in situations that they get sent on a mental health crisis call. And the only available solution they have is to take the person to the county jail. Doesn't matter what they want to do. Doesn't matter, that's the only tools that they have, and they have to work with the tools they have. So that's kind of what I meant. Just as a sidelight, I work with the meter maids in San Luis Obispo. Got to know them pretty well, and went to a parking lot once, and all the meters were expired, and every car had a ticket on it, including the chief of police, but not mine. So I've gotten to know officers on a very personal basis as people, and they are. And I don't want to vilify the police officers, because that's not the problem. The problem is the system that rewards the prisons for having more people in prison. And so that's what I'm trying to bring to light today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Nori, right before, so an Oregon, a religious community like ours, it's part of Judaism. You've given us the background from thousands of years, the commitment to this. So Unitarian Universalists, you know, we, our first principles, we affirm the dignity and worth of every human being. And we're going to be adding love, which has not been in our seven principles, you know, probably this summer at our big convention. And, but I'm wondering if a church like ours should really have something more in its statement and covenant about that. So maybe our social justice will get with you, Rabbi Harry, you know, to talk about that. We have some good people here, not only Matt, but Linda Heiderer, who's been working at San Quentin, not working, but being with the No More Tears project at San Quentin of gentlemen and women coming out. All right, Nori, you're off.
I have a quick question. I worked very hard to resist the expansion of the Contra Costa jail. And one of the big ideas for why it was, one of the big things they said for why they should expand it was to give better treatment to the mental health patients. And I just wanted to ask you, have they been giving better treatment to the mental health patients since they aren't stuck in Martinez?
So what's happening in Alameda, and I assume it's happening everywhere, is that when the jail expands to a mental health facility, the professionals that staff the facility are sheriffs. There's, you know, they'll have a psychiatrist on staff and they'll have some social workers on staff, but the vast majority of people who are working that hospital, that's what it's called, are sheriffs, are trained to be police officers. Peace officers, and they're not trained as mental health professionals. So the reason that we're trying to move the funds from expanding the jail to its mental health facility to using existing mental health professionals in the community is because it's not a law enforcement issue. It's not an issue of incarceration. It's an issue of the mental health. That's where the focus is. So I think what you're doing is great. And I'm sorry to hear that you have the same problem we have.
Well, I just wondered, you don't know whether Contra Costa is doing better by their mental health patients than they were before. I just didn't know.
I don't know. The sheriff of Nottingham, I mean, sheriff of Alameda County is very unresponsive.
Yes,
to us. We have tried to meet with him. We've tried to, you know, to communicate with him. He's not interested in this program at all. And that's why he's loaded peace officers onto the committee that's dealing with this right now for this county's Board of Supervisors. And those people who are on this committee are committed to incarceration. It's just, that's where their bread is buttered.
Well, I have one quick other question. I also understood that in terms of the horrors of private prisons is that if they have so many beds, whether they're empty or full, we have to pay them for that bed, whether there's even anybody in it.
I'm not sure about that. I don't doubt it, but that's not where the money is made. The money is made by, you know, the meal budget. Mm-hmm. You know, they get a certain amount of money per prisoner per meal, mm-hmm. and then they don't spend that total, and so that's profit. And they get to use the people who are incarcerated as to do work, prison work.
Yep.
Sometimes the prison gets paid for that. They usually do, and the workers do not, which is slavery, I think. Mm-hmm. The it's not the number of beds that are the issue, I don't think, with the private prisons. It's the way the money that they're given is spent.
Right.
And it you know, they might get money for mental health treatments and then use their officers to treat people. I don't know the answer to that, and I don't want to impugn anybody. because I just don't have the answers to that.
Yeah, we should get rid of private prisons in the first
place. Yeah, I'm opposed to private prisons. I don't think that anybody should be making a profit on prisons. I worked at the California Men's Colony down in San Luis Obispo. And the chief chaplain's chief aide was Tex Watson from the Manson family. And I would walk in the room and I was terrified. I mean, he just exuded evil, okay? I don't want to say anything bad about an individual, but he scared me to death. And I would never, I literally walked sideways around the room with my back to the wall. I was irrational, totally irrational. Having said that, Tex Watson belongs in prison, okay? I mean, what he did was criminal, immoral, et cetera, et cetera. And he had to be incarcerated. And I dealt with other people in the California Men's Colony who had mental challenges or mental disabilities, who had done horrible things. That they were in prison for crimes that anybody would be in prison for, murder or something like that. So I'm not opposed to prisons. I just want to make that clear. I'm opposed to the system that rewards the prisons for incarcerating people, and specifically people with mental illness.
And people of color.
And people of color, of course. I will tell you another horrifying story. When I was working at Lompoc, not only did I work at the penitentiary, but I worked at the prison camp across the street. I was working with the commander of the penitentiary, trying to get a better diet for the people who had become religious, Jewish religiously, and wanted to keep kosher. You know, people get very religious in jail, at least for the time they're in jail. He had no interest in that. They had common fare, which meant that the Buddhists and other vegetarians would have peanut butter and jelly for a meal at least 7 times a week, and salad. So he was satisfied that they were. So he was not the most accommodating person either. What he did was he would bring 30 prisoners, Jewish prisoners from the prison camp in chains, leg irons, waist irons, across the street from the prison camp to the penitentiary. They'd go through metal detectors, et cetera, et cetera. They'd be marched up to the office where they would take off the chains, et cetera, et cetera. And they would do the business for the prison. There were too many accountants and other professionals there. And so he thought that would make a good prison, make a good office staff. And when one of my students, I used to go there to teach, sure I did, and would be released, he would look for another Jewish prisoner to come and take his place. Because that's what he thought was the best way to run the office at the prison. This is where we started. Those of you who were with me at the very beginning of this discussion, this is what, you know, this stereotype of Jews that leads to the taking of a synagogue in Texas. And here is, you know, he's a high paid, theoretically intelligent man who is just, that's the way he runs his prison. He wants Jews to keep his books. There was a president of the United States recently who made a statement like that, you know, while he was running for office, I won't mention any names. He said he'd rather have somebody wearing a yarmulke and have a beard doing his books than having et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, his initials are Donald Trump. I didn't say that. Bad rap. Any other questions, comments?
Cordell, did you have a question? I had seen.
I have a concern, but it's really, I'm not sure if this forum is the right place, but I'm an economist by training. And if you look at American history from the beginning with colonialism, it was a business. Our founding fathers understood it was not a surprise. They understood that we were building our economy on labor that was stolen and legalized. It was legal trafficking. It was no accident. And so while we keep talking about this history like it's something that just happened, we're not owning that we did this with intentionality. And until we own that, we're not going to fix it with clarity and honesty. If they had books, if the books had been opened in 1619 and the debt had been logged for the stolen land and the stolen lives, I think estimates go as high as $50 trillion. So somewhere we should have a ledger that says, oh, by the way, here's what the country somehow needs to compensate me for. But we never really get to the honesty of saying we built this knowingly and still build policy at each phase, as each evolution of this, we build policy with, I guess, with the wink, wink to say, well, here's the best we're going to do right now. But it's always been legalized government power to take from those who are the target, so to speak. So my concern's always until we get at that big at the level of the DNA of this country and talk at that level, we're never going to put the resources to take the resources it will take. We cannot afford our conscience right now. Our conscience is bigger than our checkbook as a nation. And so how do we get to that place where we start to go and nod and go, yes, that's true, we did this. And if we're really right, if we want to be America, let's figure out how to fix this. We don't get in that direction by thousands of percents of the real value we're talking about. So part of me is while I'm listening, and I appreciate all this work, and I appreciate the intention, but I'm still saying we haven't framed it correctly yet. And until we frame it, we're not fixing it. So, but that Solani would probably read in my brow, you know, and my furrows and such as I chafe, you know, but yeah, I'm just making notes so that later on, we really want to talk about this. We have some well-framed thinking, you know, but that's what was on my mind.
You know, it always makes me curious why, you know, men and women who make a lot of money in Hollywood or in basketball or in sports don't just put together this, you know, some of the system needs that if we're real clear, you know, like you showed the statistics, Rabbi Harry, of 48%. And these are mentally ill, not robbing anybody, not doing any crime, just, you know, mentally ill. I don't know why we don't have some of our own institutions. That's something.
But I think our education makes us misunderstand the problem. Mm. If we were willing to talk about the true history of the country, we might take a bigger grip on the problem and be more effective in policy going forward. But if we prevent people from understanding it, then we're doing the whitewashing, and we whitewash, you know, according to what we do or don't want to do to address the issues. And so it's we whitewash our leaders, you know.
So we're a strong church in terms of, if you knew the thousands of cards for the last election, the time, you know, you've heard from Nori, Dorothy Hertzberg's here, so many people in this church really work hard. What would you say as kind of final words, you know, Rabbi Harry, that we could do? Should we be writing to our, you know, board members, our county board members? What's your advice?
I think that the writing to our county representative, our county board members, board of supervisors, is kind of the least we can do.
Okay.
But first, we have to find out what the facts and statistics are in Contra Costa County, right? And then we have to begin the process of making sure that we're electing people who are concerned about this. We have to work on reparations. I agree with you, Cordell, completely. I think that there's a committee finally in Congress at least has brought up the issue. I mean, it hasn't passed anything and hasn't gotten out of committee, but at least it's being acknowledged by some of the congressional representatives. And that's what we have to support them. And we have to, again, educate ourselves. You're absolutely right, Cordell. There's so many things that we don't know. I grew up in New Jersey, as was mentioned, and I grew up in a little suburban city, town called Livingston. And I remember so clearly, like it was yesterday, that we learned about the Lenni Lenape tribe whose land we were occupying. Now, I don't know if we used the term occupied, but we certainly learned about the culture of the people who were there before we got there. Okay. And so we were aware of the fact that that we had certain amount of, I don't know, we certainly didn't have the idea of reparations that was not being taught, but at least we were aware that there were people there. And this is an issue that we as Jews are facing every day when we talk about the Palestinians and their role and how we can solve a problem between the two people there. It's never as simple as just saying, you know, here's what we took back, right? Somebody used the example the other night saying, if I stole your cow, and I said, yeah, I stole your cow, so I'm going to give you cheese for the rest of your life. Instead of saying, here's your cow, right? There's a lot to be said and to be studied and thought about. There's no easy solution to the issue of reparations. I'm sure you can answer this as well as I can. And since these problems are overwhelming, I, as a person, pick a corner of the world that I work on repairing. And I think that everybody should make a commitment to repairing something and then go ahead and do that and put in the time and the effort. And education's so important. As I said before, for me, white privilege was an idea that my daughter understood a lot better as an eighth grade teacher than I did. And at many of our meals, I was berated for not understanding. And so I began the process of reading and learning, and I think I'm better. I've joined every READY group, every racial equity and diversity and inclusion group that is available to me. At the synagogue, on a national level, at St. Mary's College. This is my goal for me. I'm retired. I have a lot of time to go to seminars and this. The only good thing about Zoom is that I've gotten lessons from people all over the country in the things that are important to me. And we all can take some amount of time and do that. So I'm not addressing your absolute important issue. But we all, you know, what do they say? A trip of a thousand miles begins with a single step, right?
Right.
So each of us has to make that first step.
Thank I you, have Steve. One other thought.
Please. Cordell, sure. I'm sorry. We've got like 30 seconds to get there. So we've got Helen and you.
Fine.
Can Helen go? And then
please.
We'll, okay. Helen, you're muted, baby.
This will be very quick, and I really want to support Cordell in what he said. And the answer, we take a step. It's what we can do. But I do have a question because I haven't quite gotten this clear in my mind. 50% you say of the prison population is African American. 48% is mentally, sure. have mental problems. But I don't know how those. You know, they're not the same 50% or 48.
No.
How does that?
There's an overlap. I don't.
What's the overlap?
I don't know the statistics. I can't even guess. But definitely there are a number of BIPOC, you know, people, Black, Indigenous, people of color, who have mental challenges from the stress of society. I mean, society is not making life any easier for any of us. And those of us who are less firmly on the ground and don't have the support systems that we're fortunate enough to have, you know, the clarity that we're lucky to be blessed with, end up in the prison system. That's the end of it. That's the beginning and the end of it.
Helen, I can talk to you more about that in Contra Costa County.
Thank you. All right, Cordell, did you have those final words? And we'll
just the idea that the question that echoes in my mind as I rant is people go, what can I do? So I'm thinking that we should answer that question. We should have organizations that spend their time figuring out how to facilitate and leverage what we understand about the problem, and then a dashboard where people can go and find doable things that they could match with their capacities and willingness to extend themselves. So I just think let's start talking about the use cases. What can we do and build out a platform so that we can answer that question at the very least?
Absolutely. I think that we need our own reparations committee. We were able to, the Germans were able to do it with the people that were the victims of the Nazis, and the U.S. government was able to do it with the people who were incarcerated, the Japanese Americans who were incarcerated. Why can't we do this too? Besides the fact that it's $50 trillion and we don't have $50 trillion, but we can make a start. And I agree with what you're saying. And I would like to see reparations committees popping up all over the place, like the Ready committees are, and it'll happen. Just hasn't happened yet.
I think that might be a great project for our church, because reparations are misunderstood. They think, giving money to the Negroes. It's like, what are you talking about? It's education. It's all kinds of things that make for everybody. And the student loan, forgiveness is a nice big step for everybody.
Yeah, I would like a little appreciation for helping build this amazing nation.
And I thank you. I thank you and your people. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. All right, that's handled.
And you've got the final words, my love.
Yeah, I'm a little crisis here. But thank you, Rabbi Harry, as always. Wonderful presentation.
Absolutely.
Very thought-provoking. Appreciate your little sense of humor. I like the way you do initials. It's great. And we hope to host you again in the future. And in the meantime, thank you so much for all of your work that you've done now and over the years. It's just truly inspirational.
That's very kind. Thank you all for listening. And I like to say, wasting a morning with me.
Never a waste, Rabbi Harry.